Welcome to the 20% True Podcast, Season 5, Monster of the Week, Episode 7, The Fish Tank. I'm Carolyn Rahman. Meg is in the home of a millionaire who poisoned his mother, when she's distracted by the most beautiful fish tank she's ever seen. It's like a 3-foot-thick window between the kitchen and the living room, the water beautifully clear. She can see straight through to the stand mixer. She can read the time on the stainless steel microwave. The tank sits on a marble counter, wide enough that the millionaire could sit on one of the bar stools and eat his dinner. Maybe a line of sushi and a crisp white wine. She bends low to watch a pink fish, the color of danger. An antheus, she'll later learn, darts behind a bright yellow coral. She'll learn later that it's a leather coral. Tiny fish in electric blue hover, still as if they're suspended on strings. Purple angelfish wiggle and dart. A red and green striped shrimp works its fingers as if weaving, the way she remembers the ancient Greek women would work in a maintained frenzy. Her head tilts as a silver school flashes above her, swirling into a torus. What a beautiful thing, living and breathing, yet curated, maintained like a painting, the colors in constant motion and constant balance. It's a beauty that is not mobile, like the excessive house around her. There is no taking this wonder with her. She snaps a photo, which is woefully lacking. It holds none of the grandeur, none of the life. The fish are blurry and hold none of the vibrancy, none of the life bottled so tightly, so densely into such a small package that it has no choice but to burn bright, to dart and wriggle and swerve in bursts of fear and anger and lust. The millionaire babbles from the floor at her feet. He sees something that she's not privy to, even though she sent the hallucinations on him. She rubs at the lens on her phone camera and takes a video, a slow pan of the tank. I want something like this, she thinks. And then she nearly drops her phone, because she can't have a fish tank. She can't want a fish tank. Where would she put it? Where would she find the time to maintain it? When would she get to sit and watch it with a row of sushi and a crisp white wine? She cuts off the video and doesn't even bother to glare at the millionaire. She simply leaves, on to the next pull from the next horrible person. She leaves, but the idea of the fish tank follows her. The next stop is a man passed out asleep across the bench seat of his truck that's pulled over to the side of the road. He knows what he did, and he's been running from her, but it didn't work. The next stop is fresh and grisly. The body is still on the ground. The murderer is still sobbing, folded over the body. There's blood everywhere. What brings Meg up short is the treehouse. It's set into a huge ancient oak, the main room suspended in the canopy like a gazebo in the sky, the branches cradling it like a bird in its hands. It looks more like the tree grew that way than that it was inserted into or onto the tree. There's a smaller platform out to the side, resting on a thick branch that reaches out, as if offering up the telescope that's sitting there for the world to see. It's so lovely and peaceful, and unlike the horror spread out behind her on the back veranda. Completely separated, and yet not, because the people behind her built this treehouse. They measured the thickness of the branches to cut holes in wooden slats. Together, bigger hands guiding smaller ones, smaller hands holding the end of the measuring tape, then leaning in to read the number, just as he leaned in now over the body. They looked at the tree enough, together, spread out on the grass, with a little head on a larger shoulder. They cared for the tree enough to see how a playhouse would fit, to make precise calculations of its reaching arms, so like the arms of the child reaching up with love. The builder loved their child so much that they rented a truck and spent too much money at the lumberyard and set up a power saw in the backyard while the neighbors complained of the noise and their face complained of the tightness of the safety goggles. They cut and recut and swore and threw things, but then went back to it and finished it. Meg takes out her phone and snaps a picture, this time sending it to the group text she had with her sisters. "Look at this!" The murderer behind her gasps, "Who are you?" Her phone dings with, "Whoa, what's it like on the inside?" She turns to face him, and he recoils at the sight of her. If it's the bat-like wings, or the snakes that slither around her neck and wrists like sinuous jewelry, the snakes that writhe through her hair, as if she's still in motion between tasks, the wind whipping at her hair. If it's her eyes that grow green and unmoved. Is that a treehouse? Are you getting vengeance on a big-shot architect? She doesn't usually speak on her stops. It's rare that people even notice her. "You know who I am," she says. He doesn't really, but he does. He bows his head over his father. "It was an accident," he says. Meg doesn't care. She has a job, and the job doesn't care either. "Just some family's house," she texts. It takes 4 days for her to go longer than 10 minutes without thinking about the treehouse. Says Tizzy. They're in a private text message thread because Electo hates this kind of talk and gets bossy and snippy if she ever hears it. "You know I set nightmares on a dude who unplugged his brain-dead mom. What was he supposed to do?" "I don't like thinking about it," Meg texts back. She's on a bus traveling through the desert. She's somewhere in South Asia, but couldn't tell you more than that. She's already taken care of the passenger in the seat behind her, but she doesn't feel another pull at the moment. And it's peaceful, despite the screams of the woman behind her that there's a monster on the bus. "A monster! She's covered in snakes! They have to get off the bus!" "Just get it done and move on. It's easier that way," she texts. "How can you do that? How can you sleep at night?" Meg doesn't sleep, as Tizzy very well knows, but she gets what her sister's saying. "There's not anything I can do about it, so why make it harder on myself? Why should I torture myself if I don't have to?" "Have you tried not answering the poll?" The question makes Meg uncomfortable. She doesn't want to think about her sister not doing her job. She doesn't want to know what would happen to the fabric of the universe if they found out they didn't have to do the one thing they were put on Earth to do. The one thing they'd done for thousands and thousands of years. She doesn't answer the question, and Tizzy shifts the subject. "There's this warlord dictator guy. I've been following him. He's awful. You should see some of the things he's done. So much worse than anything I've seen in the past year with the people I'm supposed to be torturing." "You're following him?" Meg asks. Tizzy ignores her. "But he hasn't killed his father, so I can't touch him. One guy who definitely deserves it, and there's nothing I can do. I'm stuck handing out nightmares to nobodies in hospitals." Meg feels a pull, and is thankful to tuck away her phone and follow. Meg starts to notice the different flooring options in the building she visits. She makes notes of interesting floor plans, of kitchens that look onto living rooms, and sunken tubs that look out onto ocean views. She starts to inspect crown moldings. She sets up a Pinterest board, and a month later, she realizes she's designing a dream house. That's what people online call it. A dream house, not because it's impossible, but because it's perfect. For Meg, it's impossible. It's a dream, and she's a goddess of nightmares. She's drawn to Greek columns, which she knows is tacky by today's standards, but they remind her of home. Besides, it's not like anyone would judge her when they visited her house. "I've been thinking about this fish tank," she tells Tizzy. She attaches the video, and it takes way too long to load. She's up in the mountains, and the reception is awful. She hopes she gets another pull to someone in a city. Someone in a city, but not in an elevator or a subway, she amends. Tizzy jumps straight to the heart of the matter and says, Oh, you should get one! Get one? Where would I put it? I don't know. Can you get a storage unit or something and visit it when you're not busy? When she's not busy, she scoffs to herself. There's no one in the mountain to hear her. The murderer has already run away, out into the cold, apparently thinking his small shelter was on fire. Just put it on the same credit card you use for your phone, Tizzy says. Oh, look at the blue ones! It's like they're neon! Definitely get some fish like that. Meg sends her sisters a selfie from the Monterey Bay Aquarium. She hurried from the dark sidewalk outside, where she struck a murderer with hallucinations, and slipped her way inside, avoiding the security cameras, fighting against the tug in her gut to the next call, all the way to the tropical fish. She can barely make a decent smile. The urge to keep moving is so strong, it turns into pain. But it's dark in the aquarium, except for the dimly lit tank, and you can barely see her face. She snaps a photo and flies, landing gasping at her next destination. Tizzy sends a link to a news article about the warlord dictator guy. He wears a military uniform covered in braids and winking medals. Yesterday, he threw 36 teenage boys, all protesters at a silent sit-in, into a craggly ravine. Meg feels sick to her stomach. Not a one was related to him, Tizzy reports. Not even distantly. Stop trying to find a reason to torture him, Alecto says. Don't you have enough to do? Alecto sends a news article about a man who ran shrieking to the feds, collapsing in the lobby outside security, holding his head and shouting that he did it, he did it. The feds were after him for embezzlement, but they got him on murder. Good work, Meg says. That's how you do it, Alecto says. Yeah, way to bring those white-collar criminals to justice, says Tizzy. They argue in a flurry of texts. Meg silences her phone. Meg punishes a real estate agent and can't help but notice that the house they're in is for sale. Is it poor form to buy a house from a murderer's partner? Does she really want a house in Ohio? She'll keep looking. She doesn't think about that last thought too hard. She takes a photo of an estate for sale in Cyprus. She sends it to Tizzy, who pings back immediately that it's gorgeous and Meg should make an offer. Tizzy's enthusiasm reminds her that this is a terrible idea. She tucks away her phone and flies to the next murderer, pulling a string behind her navel. Alecto sends an article from a local Canadian paper that a serial murderer turned himself in, his guilt tearing him apart. Tizzy sends them both an article about the warlord dictator guy. He dropped poison gas on a town populated by an ethnic minority. Meg sends a selfie in front of the Acropolis. Look where I am! Tizzy sends several rude emojis that imply that the ancient Athenians can suck on her snake hair. Then, oh man, remember those guys? Justice should be dealt by the courts and not vigilantes, Alecto mocks, followed by 5 middle finger emojis. Tizzy sends Meg house listings. Quiet, secluded estates on a howling moor. Villas with red tile roofs and ancient fountains, set behind high walls. Ski cabins set high in the mountains behind acres of fir trees. It's this that gets her in trouble when she accidentally sends one to the group text. Oops, wrong number, Tizzy says. Wrong number, Alecto says. Meg can nearly hear the screech across the ocean that divides them. Whose number were you sending house listings to? 3 dots appear, then disappear, then reappear. Finally, Tizzy lands on, no one's? Meg drops her head to the table in front of her. The surface is sticky. She's in a club with lasers flashing through the fog powered by smoke machine. Everyone around her is in tutus and feathered boas and bracelets of glow sticks. Even with her snakes, she's one of the most conservatively dressed people. Are you buying a house? Electro screeches over text. You can't buy a house! I'm not buying a house, but if I wanted to, you couldn't stop me. What would you do with a house? Put things in it? Things? What kind of things? The 3 dots appear and then disappear. fish? Meg groans out loud. She needs a drink. Good thing she's in a club. Now the three dots are appearing and disappearing from Electo. Finally, Meg, do you have something you want to share? Meg types, no. The bartender nods at the phone in her hand and asks her in Spanish if her friends aren't coming to join her. Gods, I hope not, she says. I like your hair, he says. She downs two shots. The lecture on her phone comes in paragraphs, coming so fast that Electro must be using her magical swiftness to type. It's easier to breathe when the words blur together. Leave her alone, Tizzy says. Admit it. You're the only one who doesn't think this agent of vengeance thing is getting old. Meg signals for another shot. She downs it before she gets another pull in her stomach. Time to go. Again. By the time she's done with her next call, Electo has rage quit the conversation. She calls Tizzy a betrayer and signs off. Treacherous to her calling and to her family. Meg feels at the moment the warlord dictator guy beheads his father. It's a jerk that nearly makes her stumble, and she knows instantly who it is, what's happened. She doesn't even think that she should leave it for Tizzy. She just flies. But Tizzy's already there, standing over the warlord with her wings stretched wide like a thunderclap, with all her snakes out and sizzling. The warlord is cowering below her, jaw open in a scream that's part rictus, part face-melting. Meg hasn't seen her sister in person in ages, and they'll have to have a discussion about her flower print tunic over jeans. But for the moment, Meg falls into place at her sister's side, her own wings out, her own eyes glowing with dizzying satisfaction. The warlord's eyes fall upon her, and his horror doubles. The hissing is so loud it's overwhelming, a physical pressure that only increases as the third fury appears. And then it stutters. Because there's Electo, answering the call. And they really shouldn't be surprised to see her, but they are. The three of them together to enact their rage for the first time in generations. They circle the warlord, who's crying and screaming and already tearing at his hair. They spend longer on him than usual, taking turns ripping new terrors through his mind. When they're done, he's flat on his back on the floor, his eyes washed white. His chest barely rising, his mind blank. Tizzy pulls in her wings. Her face mellows, shifting from barred teeth and fiery eyes. She smooths a hand through her hair to calm the snakes. But she can't calm them completely, because they're still riled at Electo's presence. You came? Yeah, Electro says. Well, he killed his father. But we were already here, and you came. Electo shrugs. She looks away. A grin spreads across Tizzy's face. She shoots out a finger at her sister and crows, "You hated him too, you did!" Fine. He was awful. There's no arguing that. And you were just waiting for your chance. Fine, yes, stop. Tizzy cackles. When she calms down, they turn to Meg, who shrugs. "Are you really buying a house?" Electo asks. Meg shrugs. It would just be nice, not to be on the move all the time, to have something that was mine besides my phone and the clothes on my back. I'd like some fish to take care of. I'd like to cultivate some beauty. Electo doesn't look like she gets it, but she's not ticked anymore. There's another pull in Meg's stomach, another call. It's never ending. From the disappointed look on her sister's faces, they feel it too. It probably can't happen, though, Meg says. Electo reaches out, and they fall into a hug. Tizzy gets pulled in, too. For a moment, they just hold each other. You already have something that's yours, Electo says. Us. Forever. And they all nod, squeeze once more, then they disperse. Called to the far reaches of the globe, they fly. Thank you. podcast was written and produced by me, Carolyn Rahman. Music was composed by Kamiku. If you like the show, be sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts so other people can discover it. Follow the show on Facebook at facebook.com/20percenttrue. Visit my website, 20percenttrue.blogspot.com, for updates, thoughts on writing, and book reviews. And follow me on Twitter at Carrie and the Hits.